History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and then listen to those memories as they emerge. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only do we become educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired, especially when we compare the challenges in our lives with the ordeals so many of these men and women endured. I trust you had a meaningful Thanksgiving with the ones you love, and I know one item on the list of things to be grateful for every Thanksgiving at the Lloyd home in Placitas, New Mexico, is that 77-year-old Jim Lloyd survived through the night on August 6, 1972, and somehow made it out alive on August 7th. A few months back, we met the helicopter pilot who was awarded the Navy Cross for rescuing Jim 50 years ago, and on our last episode, we heard the beginning of this saga from the pilot's point of view. We're going to let Jim recap some of that here just to set the stage.
So I finally got one of my two radios out of my flight gear and called up Art, who was overhead. Of course, he knew from when you eject, you send a beeper coming off your seat. It goes on every radio frequency. It tells him that I got out, but it doesn't tell him if I made it out or if I'm killed on the ground or whatever. And I told him I was alive. And I had literally people 6 feet and look, stop and look right at me, and I'm in the open, and they wouldn't see me. Anyway, when I had a chance, when they move around looking, I called him up, told him I was alive. He said, Lieutenant Commander Bernie Smith, who was our ops officer, was another tremendous pilot, was inbound to help him. So Bernie, I could hear him on the radio calling me on my little handheld radio, but he could only hear static when I called back. So he said, Jim, Mike, key me in. Left, two, right, one. And well, he had his lights on, and he's flying low and very fast, and everybody was shooting at him. I was really surprised. Not only there were more people there than I thought, but there were also, seemed like everybody had some kind of a firearm. And they were shooting at him, and Mike did keyed him in, and then when he was overhead, I told him, okay, you're overhead now. And he was either being painted by radar from a destroyer or one of the E-2 surveillance planes that we had flying over the Gulf or the South China Sea. They never went overland. He told them, and they're watching him, so they had a rough idea where I was. We didn't have any of the fancy gear we have today with GPS, satellite imaging, or any of that kind of stuff. And then I told him to turn his lights off. I didn't want any company down there. They told me that a helicopter was coming in. And I looked around. I wanted to get out of there so bad. I was emotionally a wreck. And I'll get into that in a minute. But I told him, I said, there's no way a slow mover is going to survive this. And so I said, turn them back. I'll have to call him, went in later. I got to move. I was going through shock. You know, 1 minute I'm flying an airplane. It was comfortable cockpit, familiar cockpit, and shower and an hour and a half away. And now I'm in the enemy's backyard. I was 150 miles north of DMZ, 21 miles in from the coast, in an area I was told when I got back that no Americans were ever seen again that went down that area. Wide open spaces and people all around. I decided I had to move. And so I told the A-7s, I said, my thinking was, bomb on the other side of the rice paddies. One of them went in, dropped 2 500-pounders, and they were just tremendously loud. I'd seen them going off, obviously, from the air for almost half a year, but boy, on the ground, they were terrifying, the noise and the shockwave. But the light scared me the worst because it lit me up. I could see people, faces and everything all around me looking that direction. I said, knock it off, it's not going to work. I had been in that area for about an hour, and I, like I said, it was probably 9:30, 10 o'clock at night now, and I had to get out by daylight. There's no way somebody like me could hide in the daytime. So I'd been watching 11 North Vietnamese about 40 yards from me, and the reason I know there are 11 of them is I assigned each one a number so I could keep track of them, because I don't want to get on the radio and have one or two of them close by and hear or see me. When they all be clumped together, I talked lowly on the radio. Well, I made sure they were all clumped together, And I said, I got to move north. And the only reason I went north is because it just seemed to be quieter. So I slowly snuck away, leaving the voices behind me. When they disappeared to silence, I took off at a dead run. And I went up probably an eighth of a mile, maybe a quarter of a mile, and got down to call them and tell them I was on the move. And I made an almost fatal mistake. I took my two survival radios, two water bottles, took them on my survival gear, my vest, because the vest was making all kinds of noise, and I dumped the vest and tucked the water bottles and the radios in my Anna blackout suit and my pant legs, and they'd slipped out, all of them. And without a radio, there's no rescue. And so I slowly turned around, and I worked my way back. There was clumps of grass and all over the place. There was people all over the place. Well, I used the voices of those 11 men that I left behind to vector me into the same little spot, the same little clump of grass that I'd been hiding in. I couldn't see. It was so dark. And I groped around with my hands, and my right hand came across the stronger of the two radios. I would have taken either one of them and retreated a second time.
And let me stop you here, because this is the part of your story that I think gets me the most. And I'm interested to hear from you later which element of it is the most mind-blowing to you. But as I try to put myself in your shoes, if I've left this hiding spot behind, I'm trying to get away from these guys, it's pitch black, I have no idea where anything is, and then I realize I lost my radio. I don't think I would have had any reasonable expectation or hope of recovering it in that situation. What told you that you could actually do this and go find that radio again?
You know, that's an interesting question, because at the time, I just figured I'd find it. I look back through the years, and that's one of those what ifs that really, really I find scary, because I can't imagine going the rest of the night without a radio, knowing that daylight is, it was like being executed at dawn. When the sun came up, you were gone. And there was no hope for rescue. Any of the sound of the planes would disappear, because they would assume that I was either killed or captured, and they're not going to risk any more planes in such a dangerous area if they don't have any confirmation that I was still alive and still free.
So that moment when you're groping around in the dark and your hand grabs a hold of that radio again, what emotionally, what did that feel like?
Well, it was obviously a feeling of relief. If that was the end of it, that would have been even really a greater relief, but it was just the beginning of the next steps. But at least I had hope. And I never, never left that radio again. I didn't tuck it anywhere. I never left my, I didn't even switch hands with it. I had a grip on that until the last minutes in North Vietnam. So I continued moving, and I'd be out in these rice paddies, and the water is probably 8, 12, 24 inches deep. It varied. Real slimy bottom, real slimy. And I'd fall down in the water, make all kinds of racket, and I'm moving away. There's people around, but not right around me, because I'm moving away from them. And I just wanted to get out of there. Heading north, I had a little wrist compass. I thought, I can't do this. It's just making too much noise. I got to find some way to travel quieter. Well, I realized that these partitions between rice paddies are a few feet wide, and they're high and dry. And I got on those, and God, I could make a really good time. I was quiet. I'd be hunkered down low to look up against the dark sky to see any light clothing so I could see anybody that might be approaching before they see me. And I was doing this for close to an hour when I heard, I was in the middle of two rice paddies, and I heard voices coming, noise. And I looked back, and two soldiers were on the same partition I was on, walking toward me. And I couldn't run. If I got in the water, they'd hear me splash. I just crawled to the side as far as I could of that little partition. I laid down in the prone position, held my breath, and I prayed. And I felt them walk by me. Then they stopped. A question was asked in Vietnamese. They walked back, and they stood over me. And then they jabbed me in the back with a rifle. And that is a feeling I can't even put in words of how hideous that feeling is. Again, Sear taught me I didn't want to be caught. And I was in a bad situation before, but I was free, and it was all over. And the thought came to my mind, I'm okay. I didn't know I had injured my neck, but I was still very mobile. I'm just going to lay here. They're going to have to carry me. Well, they jabbed me a second time, and when I didn't move that time, they argued. They started arguing. And then I heard which I thought was one running off, and then I could hear another group of soldiers about 40 yards off. I thought the individual was running too. And I figured now is my only chance. There's one guy standing over me. So I mustered all the courage I can get, and roll over as fast as I can to grab the guy's gun, fully expecting to be shot. And I was alone. And I remember my feeling was 95% relief and 5% foolish. I just thought, what if I just laid there not knowing they were gone? They had both run off not knowing, thinking that I was going anywhere, and I went, probably they were competing for credit. Well, they only went about 40 yards and told the guys that they found my body, I guess. Well, I got up and took off, and I ran down that partition. They couldn't see me, but they could hear me, and I could hear them shooting, and they all were firing in my direction. And the bullets were random. I guess some of them came real close to my ears, other ones thumping in the mud. I got down to the end of the rice paddy, and they were chasing me on the same little partition. I made a 30-degree angle cut, and they went straight, and I lost them. All I said on the radio was, "You can't believe what I just went through." So I had to continue going.
Let me stop you there for a second, because we can't believe what you just went through either. And there's a couple elements of that I want to add to. So you said the two Vietnamese soldiers, you believe, were arguing over credit, because they could be rewarded financially if they brought you in.
I was told that we were, as officers, we were worth $500 if we were captured alive. You know, that's a lot of money for them. I like to think I'm worth a little more than 500, but hey, I can't argue. But anyway, and again, because they jabbed me in the back and I didn't react. So they figured I was incapacitated. So they weren't worried about me escaping.
But we know that he did, with a little help. It's time for our first break, but we'll pick up Jim Lloyd's remarkable survival story when we come back. You'll find photos and a short video with Jim at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.